Hello, I'm Josh Cantwell, Chief Executive Officer at Grand Mental Health. Welcome to We Don't Talk About That, a podcast committed to honest, direct conversations about mental health. In each episode, we talk openly about the many different challenges that face our communities and those we serve. Together, our team and special guests explore new ways to approach mental health from progressive thinking to mindful treatment. Here's to open minds and open dialogue. Enjoy today's episode.
Hello, I'm Jessica Lobetz, and today's We Don't Talk About That episode is a very timely one entitled Coping Through the Holidays and the Power of Hope for the New Year. Joining me in the studio today is Nicholas Allgood, a licensed professional counselor and chief clinical officer of crisis services for Grand Mental Health. Thank you for joining me today, Nick.
Thanks, Jessica.
Now, I don't know about you, but I cannot believe we are already nearing the end of 2024. This year just flew by, and now many of us are scrambling. The end of the year can bring a range of stressors due to various personal, social, and professional pressures like holiday obligations, financial pressure, work deadlines, family dynamics, loneliness, isolation, and the list goes on and on. Plus, it gets darker earlier outside and it's daylight savings time. And so I know all of those things kind of bring people into different states of emotional stress or mental stress. So tell us a little bit about seasonal depression. What does that mean?
Yeah, so seasonal depression, we sometimes call it seasonal affective disorder in the clinical world. It's a type of depression that occurs when those fall and winter months are coming on and the daylight hours are shorter. So they kind of think that that relates to melatonin and serotonin reducing in the body so that it affects your mood and sleep a little bit more than it typically would. So you'll see like changes in your sleep, appetite loss, anhedonia, which is a loss of interest in things you usually find pleasurable. So it relates back to that same symptoms you see in major depressive disorder, but this is really seasonally based.
So would you say the holiday time is when folks are struggling the most with managing their mental health?
Yeah, I think the holiday seasons can be particularly challenging for many people. The stats say that 64% of people with a mental illness report that their symptoms are worse during those fall and winter months, and that 3 in 5 Americans say that the holiday season negatively impacts their mental health, and that's a NAMI statistic. So there can be a variety of factors, stress, financial pressures, family conflict, loneliness, high expectations that the holidays are going to be a joyful time and you're not feeling it. And so I think, yeah, the holidays are certainly a time where people are reporting worsened mental health symptoms.
Mm-hmm. I've never thought about that before, Nick, and I just appreciate that we are talking about something that people just haven't ever associated with the holiday season. Why do you think now more and more people are just being real with what's happening instead of, you know, ignoring that feeling of depression during the holidays?
I think more people are comfortable talking about mental health now. I think that the generational changes have accepted more vulnerability. So the increased pressure of living at this fast pace makes people more willing to talk about mental health. And so I think the symptoms always existed, the depression always existed. It's now that people are more comfortable and the stigma's a little reduced.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say to people who just aren't feeling the holiday spirit this year? We're listening to Christmas music already in stores and we're seeing all the decorations. What would you say, or how should they cope?
Yeah, I think first is normalizing that that's a completely reasonable feeling to have, is that not everyone's happy on the holidays. So setting realistic expectations that not everything's going to go perfect, that the family and societal expectations are always high and that can be challenging to meet those. I think really setting firm boundaries and prioritizing rest, engaging in those things that you want to do that feel good for you, and taking breaks. And then I think continuing to encourage them to practice that self-care and reach out for support when they need it.
So tell us about self-care. It is, I feel like, a buzzword or a buzz term now. Everyone's talking about self-care and mental health days. How does one really find out what self-care looks like for them? Because we know it wouldn't be the same for someone else, potentially.
Yeah, I think people generally have a good sense for what feels good to them. And so practicing self-care really is about finding the balance in doing those things versus things you don't find as pleasing. And so that's a variety of different activities. You just want to make sure that your activities, you're not forcing yourself into self-care activities just because you read in the book, but that it's meaningful to you.
I've tried that before. I'm literally like, what do I like to do? Life can be so busy. If you're playing multiple roles professionally and personally, I have been one to say, I don't know what that looks like, you know? Yeah. And so I've had to think back to, well, what did I used to like? Or what did I used to do when I was a child even that brought joy to me? So what would you say to someone like me if I were in your office saying, Nick, I don't even know the first place to start?
Yeah, I think it starts with experimenting, finding out what you, getting a list and trying things until you find that thing that clicks. I know that a lot of times that can be based off some personality, so you can get suggestions. If you're an introvert, these are the things introverts commonly like. If you're extroverted, these are the things that most extroverts find beneficial. But just getting that list and throwing yourself out there and trying is challenging. But when you're able to do that, when you're able to put your best foot forward, you can find that thing that's really meaningful for you to continue. And then once you've found it, you kind of branch out to different activities even.
Well, that's so powerful. We've got to find the time to invest that in ourselves and sitting down and sometimes just writing it out or thinking about it. We've got to make time for that.
Yeah, and it can be meaningful to schedule it too. I know that finding the time is hard for some people because they're not prioritizing it. So literally just throwing it in your schedule is maybe the first step in that, is making this dedicated time to yourself.
So what should people do if they are experiencing loved ones who are showing signs of depression over the next few months, or they just prefer to be left alone and may not even be saying things and that they typically would say that might be concerning for family members or loved ones?
Yeah. So I think you're going to be looking for those symptoms of depression, and you're going to help them understand that some of those symptoms are signs of depression, and that maybe they need additional support. So being patient and accepting is the first part of that. Listening, providing good quality feedback and advice. If you're noticing that the loneliness or hopelessness is getting worse, you're recommending professional help for them. You're encouraging them. A lot of times when you're suffering from depression, you begin to isolate from others. So it's important that friends and family reach out and make that effort, even when the person may not be really responding to that. And so you just want to keep making those efforts.
So what are some of the signs? You know, like you just said, I mean, many of us are not qualified in the sense that we know what to be looking for in terms of signs. And so, I mean, I would feel bad to go to my sister, for instance, and be like, you sound depressed.
Yeah.
But what are those kind of things that we could be noticing or maybe be asking more about if we sense something?
Yeah.
And not, you know, overbearing?
So I think you can look at the different environments and kind of notice different symptoms. But overall, you're looking for difficulty sleeping, loss of appetite. They're not doing the things that they used to do that were really fun and enjoyable for them. So you're noticing them pull away from group activities, or you notice the performance at work slipping. They're calling in more often than they used to. They're laying on the couch instead of living the active lifestyle they used to. So you're noticing personality changes. You're looking for isolation. You're noticing sleep disorders or just times when they're not getting that proper rest like they should. And so that begins the cycle of depression. So you're looking for those early warning signs.
So now let me ask you this question, and this is kind of the heavier side of depression when we start thinking about things like suicidal ideation and suicide. So what are the latest statistics related to suicidal ideation and suicide during the holidays?
Yeah, so we know through research that suicides are actually a little higher in the summer and spring months. So suicide statistics are really hard to get for a variety of reasons. They just don't exist in the way that they could because of the different states label them different ways. But what we know is that the depression increases during the winter months, and anytime you have an increase in depression or feelings of hopelessness and loss of the hope, that you're going to deal with increased suicidal thoughts.
So how do you explain, or could you explain, the difference between suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation, and suicidal intent? How do each of those present differently?
Yeah, so suicidal thoughts are fleeting or passive thoughts of suicide, so they may come and go pretty quickly. They're thinking, maybe I'd be better off dead. Maybe it's better if I don't wake up today. suicidal ideation is those thoughts are coming more. They're persistent. They're frequent. You're thinking about maybe wishing you're dead, but maybe more. Maybe thinking, starting to think about ways you could end your life. And then that intent is the actual planning and desire. That's where you're rolling out your plan. You're getting everything in order. You're starting to give away your stuff. And so the intent means that there's a serious and imminent problem.
So tell me about some warning signs that people could be paying attention to or should be paying attention to when it comes to suicide.
Yeah, so I think the most common or the ones you see the clearest are just talking about suicide. So they start talking about wanting to die or how they would kill themselves if they could. And then you start to notice feelings of hopelessness, that withdraw, sudden mood changes, giving away your possessions. I know a lot of people, as they get closer to suicide, they will begin to give away stuff like an elderly person often does when they're starting to pass away. And then you've got some more subtle signs than just those overt. There's a sudden relief after a long period of depression that you may notice. There's an increase in the drugs and alcohol that subtly increases. Maybe they were drinking socially at first, and then you begin to notice that they're drinking early in the morning or that they're starting each day with alcohol. And then aggressive or reckless behavior. So a person who's not had a history of being aggressive suddenly has road rage every day, or they're yelling at those who are close to them in their family. So those may be some more subtle symptoms to look for when you're looking at suicide.
What about for the younger population? When we're talking about teenagers, are those symptoms and signs the same, or how would they show up differently?
They're a lot similar, and there's a lot of interesting research actually with regard to using school grades to monitor for early signs of suicidality. So it's kind of emerging research. There's quite a bit out there, but I think they're continuing to look into this, where if you have let's say a straight A or A and B student, and they're suddenly getting C's and D's, there's something going on. We need to figure out what that is. And sometimes that something may be suicidal thoughts or depression.
So if someone opens up about feeling suicidal, what are the most supportive and effective ways to respond in that moment?
Yeah. So I think the first major thing you want to do is acknowledge the pain or the feelings that they're having. You're going to want to ask questions. You're going to want to say, are you suicidal? Is this something I should be concerned about? And I think that's a really tough question for people to ask. But when you're seeing the signs, it's important to ask. So you're going to get a grasp on the reality and how far that suicidal thought or intention is. And then if it's imminent, you've got kind of a course of action. And then if it's thoughts, you're going to make referrals to professional help. You're going to be supportive. You're going to check in.
So let's talk a little bit about hope, going back to the power of hope for the new year. As a mental health professional, what are your views on the power of hope?
Well, we know that one of the biggest contributing factors to suicide is feeling of hopelessness. So hope is critical. It's probably the most essential piece of preventing further mental health symptoms and then also suicide. So hope is pivotal. It's really difficult to work through from hopelessness to hope. And so we know that they're going to need a lot of support and a lot of intervention in moving to the new place that they need to get to. Just a lot of work.
And that's the thing I'm thinking about as I listen to you talk. The journey from hopelessness to hope can seem, for someone who's struggling, so far away and take so much energy. How do you get them to find the strength or the internal will to do the work?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question. So first thing we want to do is highlight small wins. Find things that are working for them or going well, increasing those small positive changes, and then finding moments of relief, moments they didn't feel like that, documenting that, journaling, working with them on how do we get that to happen again in the future. And then we want to connect them with others. That's a really critical piece of depression that we talked about, is that loneliness or isolation. And then that pairs with suicidal thoughts, is that when you're alone, it's easier to have those thoughts. And so connecting and engaging with others is critical, whether that be support groups, bowling leagues, or whatever it is. And then we also want to help them envision what the future might look like. If everything was fixed today, what would my life look like? And how do we get you there?
I really appreciate you calling out the small win. Sometimes a small win is just getting up. in the morning. or showing up. I often say, even in my own personal life, when times are hard or if I'm feeling stress, I'm here. I showed up today. I gave that my best shot. And so the small wins piece is really huge. So you said earlier, a good way to take care of yourself is identifying boundaries and enforcing boundaries. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think that's critical and very hard. So especially with family members. Family members have a way of pushing you harder than anyone else in your life a lot of times. And so I think boundaries is establishing the rules for how you move forward in life. And that means that if something makes you feel uncomfortable or if it makes you feel anxious and you don't want to do it, that you set rules in place that you don't do it. So the best thing about setting boundaries is you're communicating those clearly with the people in advance of the situation. So as you establish them, you begin to let people in your life know, this is where my boundaries are at. And you're sharing and communicating those. And that when that opportunity comes up for you to utilize those boundaries, that you stick firm and that you have practiced those over time with a variety of people before you get to your family, which may be the toughest to enforce those boundaries with.
That's what I want to say, Nick. That is so hard, you know, because you've got that loyalty piece and you don't want to hurt people's feelings or you don't want to let someone down. I'm thinking of, you know, a mom or a dad, a loved one. And so maybe guilt or feeling of not wanting to let someone down would keep, you know, someone from, you know, enforcing boundaries. How do you navigate that?
So I think focusing on what you're role modeling for other people in your life, because you want your family to have boundaries, healthy boundaries as well. And so maybe you're the first in your family or friend group to enforce boundaries and to have those. And yeah, there's a feeling of kind of like awkwardness and I don't want to do this and maybe guilt. Yeah. I think that they begin to see how healthy you're living and they want that. And so part of that is setting those boundaries and role modeling those behaviors for them. Now, I think that's a little bit tougher with your parents. They tend to think that the mentor relationship goes the other way, and it does most of the time. But it's also a generational improvement that you can focus on being a better adult than your parents were for your kids and for your other family members that may be looking up to you. So the guilt is a big thing, but fighting against that guilt for your own self is important.
You know, one of the things I remember growing up is the powerful statement or reminder that no means no. And it was for a variety of reasons. No to drugs, no to pressure, peer pressure. But even in setting boundaries, no is a full sentence, full stop. And I think there's so much power in that. And sometimes it's hard because no can come across as being mean or forceful, but there's so much power in that word and making it be a sentence and no, I'm not going to that extra thing after work or no, I don't want to do that. So tell us a little bit more about the power of no when setting boundaries as well.
Yeah, so I think reinforcing those things through practice, saying no when you're not feeling comfortable is normal and normalizing that with everyone. Yeah, everybody's heard the broken record, just say no a lot of times. And turns out it works. Turns out that if you're firm with your boundaries, people understand that you're attempting to live a healthier life and that it's not mean and it's not perceived mean. But it feels like that is going to be the reaction. And for those people who don't have healthy boundaries, it may be their reaction. I think what's kind of cool is that when you find someone else who has those healthy boundaries and who is living a healthy lifestyle or has great mental health, that a lot of times they already have those firm boundaries in place for themselves, and so they're respecting your boundaries as well.
I really like that. That's helpful. I'm actually taking that away today with me. You said something else earlier, too, about noticing uncommon behavior, and you used a particular example, someone who normally shows up to work isn't, or they're calling in a lot more, and maybe when they are at work, they're disconnected or they're disengaged. Tell me a little bit more about that and how someone, a colleague, a coworker, could maybe ask some questions to see what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's the toughest part about this is that you notice these things a long time before you're ready to talk about them with someone, because asking about depression is a big thing, especially when you use the word depression. There are softer, more subtle ways maybe to ask, like, I've noticed that you don't seem like you're as productive. Can I do anything to help? And so opening up a conversation with an open-ended questions where people are willing to express and explain more about what's going on with them. You may find out that it's just they had a rough night, or you might find out that they're suffering from a crippling depression that you were unaware of for the last 6 months. So exploring through questions, persuading them to get help, and referring to those who can help. And that means sticking with them through that process as much as you can within your boundaries as well.
So then if they don't give you anything and you still suspect something is going on, when is it okay to let go? I think because that's also, there's that word guilt again. When is it okay to let go? When is it okay to not pry if someone is just not open to sharing what's happening?
Yeah, and I don't think it necessarily, I think to help distinguish this, I think about it like you're checking in. You're going to continue to check in, but once they're not giving that feedback, you're not going to continue to dig in. So you're not going to dig past their boundaries. You're simply going to check in and let them know you're here. And the hope is there that with your boundaries, with your healthy lifestyle, they model that and they can see that you could be a person they can talk to if they're feeling like talking at any point. But that resource is always there, presenting that if it is. But not making yourself stressed out about what's going on may be helpful as well.
I really appreciate that. Checking in and not necessarily digging in. What a big distinction. But that's something, too, that I think we as folks who care about each other can remember that. Check in, but you don't necessarily have to dig in, especially if that person is saying, I don't need you.
Yeah.
I'm just curious to know why you're in this profession. Like, what led you to this particular realm of work? Why are you so passionate about it?
I have always had a passion for listening to people and helping them help themselves. And so this was a perfect place to be social and be able to impact someone's life and work through the interesting disorders that people face in their day and work on getting those to be not barriers, but things that they've overcome in their life. And so being a part of that is really important, and that's why I'm here.
What about when you've seen someone completely turn their life around, especially when we were talking about the really dark side of depression, where someone has thought about suicide or have had ideas about just ending it all? Tell me a little bit about how you've been able to see the power of someone turning around their life.
Yeah, I think I have the wonderful opportunity to see it every day. Because in the crisis units that we operate, there's thousands, literally, a year that are coming through. And a large majority of those have had some kind of, they all have a mental health or substance use issue, but a lot of suicidality in that population. So we're talking about someone who doesn't see tomorrow. And then by the time they're leaving or we're getting engaged in outpatient or even a year down the road, working and having a family and living, you know that you played a small part in that person's success. And so it becomes really meaningful.
One of the other biggest things that I think people are thinking about during holiday time is if they've lost a loved one who won't be at the dinner table. There's memories, all kinds of heartache during the holidays. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Grief is really difficult. Grief is different for everyone, and there's no length of time that's appropriate. So it's really tough to determine when grief is going to impact you. Sometimes it's all year long, every day you're living with that grief until you've figured out how to manage that. But certainly the holidays are a big time for grief because you're familiar with those family memories at that time. You've got something where your grandpa sat at the end of the table your whole life and then suddenly he's not there. So I think that grief is a strange thing where it's not as easy to fix maybe as other things because you can't bring the person back. And so you're just working on how do I move on? How do I keep positive thoughts and not let this impact my life? And so a lot of times that's grief support groups or reaching out to professional help or just being in supportive environments. Doing things that you used to enjoy doing with that person can be very beneficial. Certainly there are times that being around family and having the grief of all of you are losing that family member, it multiplies that impact. And so sometimes that means you can't be there right then, that you're somewhere else where you can focus on something else. I think you just have to find out what's feeling best for you. And then the critical thing is that if the grief begins to impact your life, that's time to do something. And that's how you know you're not through the grief yet, is when you're missing work or you're getting in trouble suddenly. You're using drugs and alcohol when you didn't before. When those symptoms start to come, you're going to have to figure out how to get that next level of help. That's the key indicator for us.
And you said finding what is right for you. And I know for me personally, when I've experienced grief, especially, losing my grandmother and losing my husband's grandmother, there are things that I do to keep their memory alive. And so it's things like baking, using the recipe of the sweet potato pie, you know, that Granny Macy taught me. Or like you said, just honoring the memory. And for me, that has helped a lot with healing. It doesn't mean that I'm not grieving or, missing them, but that's a way of honoring that memory. And so I appreciate that. And maybe whoever is listening today who might need some ideas around how to cope with the loss of a family member during the holiday, I hope we can offer that.
Yeah, certainly. And I think that's where the benefit of the support groups come from. Anytime you're in a support group environment, whether that be AA or NA or depression self-help groups or grief self-help groups, there's people who are at different stages of grief who have different ideas on how that's helpful. And so there's no better place than learning from other peers who are going through those struggles or who have been through those struggles. And like you say, honoring the family members that have passed or the friends is a very meaningful tool and one that is very common to do. And so learning those other common solutions to grief or fixes, and maybe it never fixes completely, right? Maybe we feel that in a different way, a less counterproductive way, and it puts more meaning into our life that we had that person in our life. So I think self-help groups is a great place to start. I also think there's a great place for grief therapy. Certainly hospice agencies have excellent grief counselors that work for them, because that is something that hospice is always going through.
I also am thinking about social media. We start seeing a lot of family photos and matching PJs and Hallmark movies. And, while people are excited about all of that, there may be a certain, number of folks who don't want to see that because it's reminding them of what they don't have. And so tuning out the noise or maybe avoiding things that might remind you of the pain could be helpful, right?
Yeah, I think as long as the avoidance isn't becoming a problem in itself. So as long as that doesn't lead to a lack of connectivity or you're avoiding your normal life routine, then yeah, certainly. Setting boundaries. I think it just goes back to setting boundaries. If something is making you feel worse, stay away from it. Don't do it.
Well, thank you so much, Nick. And thank all of you for joining us today. Again, I'm Jessica Lobetz, and I look forward to connecting with you soon for our next episode.
Thank you for listening to the latest episode of We Don't Talk About That, supported by Grand Mental Health. If you enjoyed this episode, we invite you to subscribe to our podcast and become part of our growing community of mental health advocates. Visit grandmh.com for more information.